This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
While we're on the topic of infrastructure, what do you do when you're in the middle of a heat wave in a place that usually just doesn't get that hot? And we round out graduation season by remembering a notable first in economics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, June 28th. Glad to have you with us. An extreme heat wave continued across the Pacific Northwest today with another round of record-setting temperatures on top of record-setting temperatures. The forecast said Portland would get up to 115 degrees today. And the sweltering heat has people scrambling for air conditioners, which are not usually seen as a necessity in a part of the country known for its rainy weather and balmy summers. But the climate crisis means more people need more AC in more places for more of the time. So it's probably a good thing that here in Washington, they're thinking about improving our infrastructure, including the electric grid. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Katie Vogue is suffering through a third day of triple-digit temperatures in Seattle, where air conditioning is becoming more common, though still only 44% of residents have it.
I have two box fans. I have some of those little ice packs that you put on an injury or something, which I actually just like put in the bed near me or on top of me.
But the dangerous effects of climate change won't be mitigated by a bag of frozen peas, says Sean Sublett with the nonprofit Climate Central.
These incidents of extreme heat are going to become more numerous, and so the demand for air conditioning is only going to be climbing further.
Climate Central estimates that home air conditioning use will increase almost 60% over the next 30 years.
That kind of scares me.
Rashi Nategi is an engineering professor at Purdue University.
It sounds to me like a very unsustainable way, right? Because we are, again, fueling what is causing this.
Already we've seen extreme weather push our energy systems to the breaking point, says UC Berkeley's Severin Borenstein.
It raises the demand at the peak times, and so it means more investment in the generation capacity to meet those super peaks.
The infrastructure deal now being discussed would dedicate $73 billion to the power grid, but leaves out big investments in renewables. Still, Jennifer Amon with the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy says there are ways to improve air conditioning now.
I think it's a mix of, right, these low-tech and high-tech solutions, the old technologies and the new.
She says better insulation and windows can help, and we can make air conditioners even more efficient. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, record highs in the markets as well as in the forecast. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Another part of this economy with high demand right now, housing. Inventory is tight, and tomorrow we'll get the latest Case-Shiller home price numbers to give us a snapshot of just what the housing market looks like right now. And while would-be homeowners longingly browse online listings, the Federal Reserve is walking a tightrope. The central bank wants to give the economy just enough juice to get it moving out of the pandemic recession, but not so much that it's creating speculative bubbles. Boston Fed President Eric Rosengren told the Financial Times, quote, "We can't have a boom and bust cycle in something like real estate." Marketplace's Mariel Segura has more on just how hard it is to strike the perfect balance.
Last year, the Federal Reserve started doing everything it could to keep the economy afloat. And one of the main ways it's been doing that
is it buys up and has been buying up since the beginning of the pandemic, billions and billions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities.
That's Peter Conti Brown, who teaches about the Fed at the Wharton School. When the Fed buys mortgage-backed securities, that allows banks to lend out more money. And with a bigger supply of money to lend out, its price, otherwise known as the interest rate, drops. Home buying becomes more attractive, and housing demand goes up.
As we've seen, prices have been going bananas in the housing market, and this is closely related to the Fed's dramatic interventions.
There was another factor. A lot of people wanted to get out of small apartments and buy bigger houses. The Fed doesn't buy mortgage-backed securities because it has a special preference for housing. It's just that the central bank's tools are limited.
The Federal Reserve Act really restricts the kinds of bonds that the Fed can buy in ordinary times. And it allows for the purchase of mortgage-backed securities in a way that it doesn't allow for the purchase of other kinds of securities absent an emergency.
Now, the Fed has not pulled back from buying mortgage-backed securities because it's still trying to stimulate the economy. Gus Fauché is chief economist at PNC Financial Services Group.
The concern is that if the Fed overstimulates the economy, in particular overstimulates the housing market, that could result in a housing bubble where house prices increase rapidly and then fall rapidly.
Fauché says we're not there yet. And in his comments, Eric Rosengren at the Boston Fed said this may not happen. But the situation shows what a fine line the Fed is walking. I'm Mary Elsegarra for Marketplace.
If you happen to miss an episode of the show, well, that's why we have a podcast. You can download it wherever you get said podcasts. We're wrapping up graduation season, but let's take a moment to recognize an economics graduate from the past who didn't quite get her flowers at the time. 100 years ago this month, Sadie T. Moselle, later Sadie Alexander, became the first African-American in the United States to earn a Ph.D. in economics. But like a lot of black women, she was denied employment opportunities because of her race.
No one hired her into a position as an economist. She eventually became a lawyer. She had a very important career as a lawyer, and she died in 1989.
That's Dr. Nina Banks, an associate professor of economics at Bucknell University and president of the National Economics Association. She recently published a collection of Sadie Alexander's speeches and writings in a new book called Democracy, Race, and Justice. For the project, Dr. Banks dug through archives and painstakingly deciphered scraps of old speeches.
I always say it was a labor of love because it took a long time, almost 20 years, for a number of reasons, only one of which was due to her handwriting. And the handwriting was a challenge.
Even though she never was able to work as an economist, Dr. Alexander did a lot of speaking and writing as a civil rights lawyer and activist. So when I spoke with Professor Banks a couple of weeks ago, we talked about what she found in the archives.
Economists assumed that after she became a lawyer that she had given up her interest in economics. And so when I went to the archives at the University of Pennsylvania in 2003, I was really shocked to find that for all of her life, she had a sustained interest in economics, the economic status and condition of African Americans. She was a proponent of economic justice. And so that's what the book is about. The book is an excavation, my excavation of her economic thought and the return of it to the economics profession.
If you'll indulge me a bit, I was struck by two particular passages because over the years, you can see through her speeches how she's grappling with an idea that's still a topic of debate, sort of this balance of personal responsibility of black people on an individual and community basis to change the situation versus the role and responsibility of government. You have a fragment of one of her speeches from the 1920s where she talks about the
poor morality rates and literacy rates of Black people are due to, quote, a failure on our part to train our bodies and our minds. Fast forward several decades to a speech she gave in 1963 called New Tempos, New Concepts. She talks about to push for change, we're going to have to, quote, do a lot more than change the self-image of Negroes. We're going to have to restructure society.
Yes, you identified, I think, a really problematic speech where she focused on, as you said, individual responsibility and group efforts, behavioral factors. But certainly her thinking shifted, I think, as she experienced discrimination and witnessed more discrimination and racial oppression. And so by the 1960s, with the speech that you read, she's really gone full circle. And so she's looking at systemic structural barriers. And that speech, I think, is really interesting because she talks about the need for a restructuring of our society so that African Americans would be fully able to participate in our society economically, politically, socially, and so on. And we are still, as you said, grappling with that today.
She wrote and spoke, of course, on the Black economic experience, but Alexander also did a great deal of work and data mining and research on gender roles and women in the workforce, and illuminating so many of the same problems that we're seeing now in the she session of the pandemic.
So in her section on women in the political economy, what I find really interesting is that the group of women she was most concerned about were African-American women who were domestic workers. Those are the women who were the most vulnerable to economic downturns, as you said. And so, absolutely, if we look at the recession today, we see that domestic workers have been especially hurt, women who are in personal service. So you're absolutely right. You know, she was prescient in many ways, and this was one also in terms of the acute vulnerability of African-American workers.
Another area in which she was pretty prescient in her writings was another debate we're having today about one of the key themes in her speeches and writing being, as you put it, her understanding of the problems of income inequality on the macro economy. And you have a question posed at the beginning of the book, literally in the first paragraph, that I'm wondering if you can try to answer, which is, how might our understanding of the economy be different today if Sadie Alexander had been allowed to work as an economist at the time, and to add to that, if even her economic contributions had been acknowledged before now?
Yeah, and I think that that is a really important question, and I think that it's a question that can only be answered by the context of the time. And the context of the time, 1920s into the 1960s, is that African-American scholars were employed at segregated institutions. So my sense is that had Sadie Alexander been able to find employment as an economist, her economic thought would probably not have influenced the overall thinking within the economics profession, because there is a tendency still on the part of economists to dismiss the critical thought of African-American economists, even in a post-civil rights era, unfortunately. It would have made a difference in the thinking, certainly, of students who would have been influenced by her, students who would have gone to HBCUs.
Nina Banks is Associate Professor of Economics at Bucknell University and Editor of Democracy, Race, and Justice, the Speeches and Writings of Sadie T.M. Alexander. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kimberly. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Likewise. Coming up,
there's strong regional differences
in how government programs play out. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average declined 150 points, 0.4%, to finish at 34,283. The NASDAQ added 140 points, 0.9%, to end at 14,500. And the S&P 500 found 9 points, 0.2%, to land at 4,290. Megan looked at air conditioning, so dialing up the AC sector, HVAC company Carrier Global rose a cool 1.7%. A federal court threw out a Federal Trade Commission antitrust complaint against Facebook. The judge didn't buy the government's argument the company has a monopoly on personal social networking. Facebook climbed 4.1%. Twitter gained 0.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.48%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. The last COVID relief package included several measures targeted towards those hardest hit by the economic fallout of the pandemic, including some changes to the tax code. Congress expanded the child tax credit for this year in two ways, both by increasing the amount of the credit and by expanding who's eligible. And for the first time, starting July 15th, families receiving the credit will get it in monthly installments instead of as a lump sum at tax time. As Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, these changes are a big deal, especially for low-income parents.
How big a deal?
This is like one of the largest expansions of an anti-poverty program we've probably ever seen. It will likely cut poverty in half over the next year, childhood poverty in particular.
Alyssa Schmier is with the advocacy organization Moms Rising.
I think most people don't think of the tax code as a place where you could really make a significant difference in the lives of families, but we're talking about a lot of money here.
A lot more money than in the past. Last year, the child tax credit was worth up to $2,000 per kid, depending on the parent's income. This year, parents will get up to $3,600 per child for kids under six and $3,000 for older kids. Elaine Mogg at the Tax Policy Center says there's another change that's even more important.
Very low-income children are being given access to the full credit.
In the past, the child tax credit phased in. So parents who earned no money or very little didn't qualify for the whole amount, whereas parents earning up to $400,000 a year did. So Mogg says,
middle and high income children were receiving the largest benefits, and the lowest income children, in some cases, were receiving no benefit.
This year, the poorest families will get the whole credit, and it'll be coming in installments every month. Mogg says that's especially significant for low income parents, many of whom have unpredictable incomes.
So you're not always poor in every single month, but in some months you have very few resources.
And that can be bad for children, she says, especially the youngest ones.
By delivering the credit on a monthly basis, we guarantee that there's some sort of minimum income coming into the household that can be used to meet basic needs to care for your children.
And pay for some extras, like sports or art or music lessons. That is what Tammy Birch's kids are most looking forward to.
Well, the kids are making plans.
Birch is a single mom, and she lives in Chanute, Kansas, with her twins, who are 10. Her daughter wants to take dance lessons, and her son wants to play soccer and football and basketball.
So I'm looking into sports programs that we can do now, that we have some money to put that way.
Birch hasn't had money for almost anything for the past year. She left her job as the dietary manager at a nursing home when the pandemic started because she was afraid for her health and because her kids were home from school and she had to take care of them. She says it took months for her unemployment benefits to come through.
So for that period of time, I had no money, $0. It was a disaster.
Even when she was working,
we were still real low income. You know, like I think my taxes, I know I made less than $16,000.
That's $16,000 a year for a full-time job. So for Birch, the prospect of getting $500 a month from the child tax credit and just having that guaranteed baseline income is huge.
That's rent. It would help a lot. It would take a lot of stress away.
Birch says it would help and not it will, because she doesn't quite believe she'll actually start getting that money. Not after everything she's gone through this last year.
I just don't put too much hope into anything anymore. You know, if it does happen, we'll be super excited. But right now, I'm just holding my breath.
She should get her first payment in July, but they'll only keep coming for the rest of this year. The expansion of the child tax credit is temporary, at least for now. Many Democrats want to make it permanent. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Even though those changes to the child tax credit are just getting going, we're at the point in this recovery where some emergency programs responding to the pandemic are winding down. Extra unemployment benefits run out in September, the federal eviction moratorium ends next month, and these programs have been controversial in terms of who they're actually benefiting and whether they're too generous. This national conversation has happened before, about other programs during other economic crises. So we got two experts on the phone.
I'm Jason Scott Smith, professor of history at the University of New Mexico.
My name is Jessamine Schaller, and I am an associate professor of economics at Claremont McKenna College.
Specifically, these are two experts at what it looked like when another government program ended following another recession almost a century ago.
The Works Progress Administration was really, in many respects, the central agency of the New Deal. It built useful public works projects across the United States, touching almost every community in the nation. It spent an enormous amount of money.
Its first objective is to put men and women now on the relief rolls to work, and incidentally, to assist materially in our already unmistakable march towards recovery.
The key context of the Great Depression was its breadth and depth, and the reality of mass unemployment shaped the nation's society and its politics. When Franklin Roosevelt took office in 1933, almost 30% of the workforce was unemployed, and for those that could find work, a third of those could only find part-time employment. The Gallup Public Opinion Poll in 1939 asked Americans what was the best thing that Roosevelt has done and what was the worst thing that Roosevelt has done. And the number one answer to each question was the same thing. It was the WPA.
One reason that the WPA was unpopular among some voters at the time was that there was a public perception that Black workers were overrepresented on work relief rolls. But in fact, that turned out to mostly be a result of the fact that Black workers were disproportionately likely to be unemployed at the time. What we found in our research is that there's strong regional differences in the access that Black workers had to work relief programs. When we look at similar Black and white workers, we find that in Southern counties, Black workers were less likely to have access to work relief jobs. This just goes to show the real importance of local program administrators. This was a federal program that was explicitly stated to have the intention of reducing discrimination and improving outcomes for Black families and for Black workers. And yet it turned out that it really depended on what region you lived in as to whether that was actually the case.
Professor Jason Scott Smith at the University of New Mexico and Professor Jessamine Schaller at Claremont McKenna. This final note on the way out, many Americans are getting their travel bug back for the summer. The Transportation Security Administration says it screened more than 2.1 million passengers this past weekend. That's the most so far this year, which means more people in airports, where, like many other places, there's a staffing shortage. CNBC reports the TSA is offering $1,000 hiring bonuses as part of its push to hire 6,000 new screeners. Airport restaurants are struggling too, with executives at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport reportedly sending a letter out to the shops and restaurants there, asking them politely not to poach each other's employees. Your moment of economic context before we go. Megan was talking at the top of the show about all the extra air conditioning use because of this latest heat wave and all the extra energy that's going to take. In May, the U.S. Energy Information Administration tried to game out what this summer was going to look like in terms of energy prices. For you and me, the agency predicts residential energy prices up 2.4% from last summer to get to almost 14 cents per kilowatt hour. In the commercial sector, prices up about 3.8%. That's the biggest year-over-year jump since 2008, and this was all assuming fewer really hot days than last summer, which isn't looking so good at the moment. Our daily production team includes Anais Amen, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.